You know, when you get up to give talks like this, you speak in tones which do not seem to encourage doubt. But I do want you to understand that that's just the nature of the occasion. And I'm very concerned to receive your criticisms and evaluations of the things that I say. In my talk yesterday, I gave my reasons for saying that the church, through its teaching and preaching, has the responsibility to explicitly address the economic proposals and processes of the society within which it ministers, including those that involve government action. Spokespersons for Christ are under the imperative to love God and to love their neighbors as themselves. Their responsibility for what honors God and what is good for the public, as well as for their closer followers, dictates that they deal with economic issues that seriously impact life and well-being. This will in turn require that Christian educators undertake to prepare those who embrace this responsibility to speak with understanding and clarity about economic issues, with reference to the government, of course, but also with reference to the major non-governmental segments of society, business, education. And one area that I have a special concern for is the professions. For example, the failure of lower education to teach all students about money, how it works, and what to do about it should be a constant concern for ministers and should be seriously dealt with by them. The same is true for other sources of well-being or its lack. Of course, they will encounter strong opposition if they do this. And that is to be expected. And this topic of money, which you've already been dealing with and some of the other speakers have addressed, is really scary today. Because I often will talk to groups and tell them, you may think you have money in the bank, but you don't have any money in the bank. What you have in the bank actually is pretty questionable as to its ontological status. But we don't have money in the bank. There's some money there, but it doesn't have my name on it or yours. And this is really an important thing to think about. We can make money appear on the other side of the earth, but not really. What we're dealing with in terms of promises, and they're not the same as money, as we have recently found out, I hope. But my main point yesterday had to do with the differing versions of flourishing or well-being that frame a secular vision of human life and that frame a Christian or biblical vision. Human flourishing and well-being have numerous possible dimensions, but a vision of what it is to have well-being or to prosper is presupposed in any evaluation of economic ideas, plans, or practices for implementation. However, economics as a field of study or inquiry does not help us with understanding what constitutes human well-being. That simply doesn't fall in its domain, though its experts often seem to presume that it does, especially if they have won a Nobel Prize. It is the task of the Christian minister to keep before the public an understanding of when human beings are well off and when not. He or she does not have exclusive responsibility in this regard, perhaps. But they do have this responsibility in a special way because of their position in society, which is a long discussion and, again, something I'm very concerned about. And because of the sources of knowledge and power they have that comes with the position of being a spokesperson for Christ. We concluded last time with some discussion of reasons why conservative evangelical churches, in particular, and their ministers, tend to back away from any such responsibility. We emphasized what I take to be a misunderstanding of the gospel as having to do only with forgiveness of sins and the afterlife, and as something with no essential public bearing or involvement, a tragic misunderstanding. Also, we pointed out that to bring knowledge of political and economic affairs is not to be political in the sense of seeking to control political persons, offices, and events. Not that that is totally ruled out, but it presents a different set of issues. Now, today I want to focus more closely upon the makeup of a life exemplifying economic wisdom. In institutions, but in individuals, and upon the role of the Christian spokesperson in promoting such a life. What does a life of economic wisdom look like? In approaching this topic, we have mentioned the misunderstanding, and we must mention it again, the idea that Christian virtues and character can be, or even necessarily are, something hidden from public view, and of no significance for how the world runs. One can, on this view, be exactly the kind of person God intended one to be, without influencing or transforming the social connections, including the government, in which we live. And we have to say again and again, the Bible, Christian history, and a careful observation all bear out the fact that this is not the case, that the transformation that goes into discipleship to Christ and Christian living is world-transforming. The early Christian movement simply transformed its world. However, we must admit, study after study in recent decades shows that the general run of Christians in North America do not differ in character from the non-Christians there. And one is suspicious that sometimes theology reflects prevailing conditions, not truth. And the fact that this is true leaves the door open for the small number of Christians who really are profoundly different to be dismissed as oddities, and for serious implications of Christian virtue for public life and order to be disregarded, both by the world and by the church itself. A part of what emerges from this picture is the usual assumption that religion has no relevance to government or even to business. Charles Stanley tells a story about his first church in which there were four or five men who thought they were running it. And they were having a meeting and couldn't come to a decision about something. And Stanley said, "Well, why don't we pray?" And one of the men replied, "This is business. Let's leave God out of it." The various professions also have to keep an eye on what is genuine well-being, and Christian ministry should help that. The truth of the matter is that the character of Christ lived out in ordinary life would transform our world, including what it means to have economic well-being and to live life of economic wisdom. Now, my first statement here, number one. For purposes of this discussion, let's say that a public or social setting exemplifies or expresses economic wisdom if the ordinary person living therein, under normal conditions, is able to engage in productive living, maybe with a job, not always, with adequate resources to meet basic needs of life, with assurance of security, and with a reasonable hope for attainment of familiar human objectives, given appropriate application of thought and effort. I like to try to say what things are. And you certainly, often they're not good statements, but I think it helps us. And so I'm just trying here to say what it looks like to be in a situation or to be a person who exemplifies economic wisdom. People generally in such circumstances would be able to lead useful and happy lives and be content with their lives, even though those lives might be far from perfect. We do not make a condition of exemplified economic wisdom in a setting that most people therein have opportunities to make it big, though that might be a possibility for some, or that someone could be economically successful without appropriate intelligent effort or without the assistance of individuals around them, family, friends, acquaintances, who contribute to their lives in ways that are uncoerced but non-commercial. In the setting we have in mind, it is important to note many wants and perhaps some needs would go unsatisfied. We are not contemplating utopia. And it is really important, in my opinion, to understand that. Now, I want to emphasize that achieving an environment of economic wisdom is not something simple, easy, or obvious. We especially want to reject the idea that there is this relatively self-contained system called the economy that runs on laws that can be discovered by clever people and manipulated in such a way that the system produces human well-being. I want to reject that in the strongest way. The system produces human well-being, general welfare, even of the limited non-utopian sort specified just now. Some seem to think that if you can just get those laws right and find experts guiding government action or inaction, find experts to tinker with them, desirable conditions in the economy, say low inflation, fair and mild taxation, care for the needy, great opportunities for all individuals, will just flood the land. As T.S. Eliot said decades ago, we're looking for a system so perfect that we will not have to be good. But such a system is not going to happen. There is no answer of that sort. Spokespeople for Christ need to say this repeatedly and with emphasis. Only so can they deal realistically with the human condition. We're going to have to say that good economic system working is not just a human achievement, but is certainly something that incorporates a great deal of grace, if not accident. Now, I think there are three main factors that go into a life of an actual life of economic wisdom. A situation successfully exemplifying economic wisdom will, I surmise, involve them. Only part of them are subject to human control. First of all, and I want to spend most of my time on this because I think it's most important, there has to be prevalence within the population of a certain range of individual characters and virtues. That is essential to economic processes. Secondly, social and political arrangements and practices that manifest much of those same characters and virtues in public life and its institutions, suitably adjusted to fit the fact that they are now social and not traits of individuals. So this raises questions about how they work, and here's what I have to say about that in short. We'll come back to it. In this, the role of leaders and their characteristics become paramount. Honest governmental or business agencies, for example, are up to leaders to see to. Here again, to believe that you can find a system that will produce the result you want at the social and political level is not a valid idea. There will be justice in the land when there are enough just men and women distributed throughout the population to see to it that justice is done. And it will help to have some good systems in place, but they will not run on their own. Human ingenuity will always find a way to beat the system if that's what they want to do. Thirdly, external circumstances. natural resources, historical events, wars, climate, storms, drought, turns of government, and things that might be termed acts of God. These are all essential in producing or destroying the possibility of a life with economic wisdom. Now, there's very little, of course, that I can say about this third point, the external circumstances, and so I will go back now to look at mainly at the first one, the primacy of individual character, and here I am at number 3 on your handout. Life exemplifying economic wisdom only emerges from the prevailing characteristics and actions of the particular persons who make up a population. The particular person is primary because only individuals are capable of action. The order or disorder in any dimension of society under usual circumstances is entirely a function of what individuals are prepared or not prepared to do. Now, this is a touchy point, especially in an academic setting, because the social sciences try to avoid choice as an explanation of anything. If you bring up a topic like a 50% divorce rate or first marriages, you rarely find anyone who says, well, the reason for that is because people choose to get divorced. And they make a series of choices that lead up to that choice. That's unfortunate that things have taken that turn. I understand that we're supposedly looking for laws, and it's very hard to formulate laws of choices. But I do think that some of the social sciences are turning in the right direction on this and finding ways to get at the role of individuals in what happens socially. Of course, what individuals are prepared to do is largely determined by the social structures and processes that form them and in which they are immersed. And that is totally so for people who are not thoughtful, not informed, not self-motivated to think critically about what they do, or who do not have leaders and teachers that challenge their habits of thought, making them to be reflective about why people do the things they do, why do they do the things that they do. So we always have to take into consideration when reflecting on economic life both the characteristics of particular persons and people and the social context and structures that actually influence people to do what they do. A very instructive case in this regard is to reflect on the people who signed up for mortgages they could not afford. And it is true, for example, they did it, they chose. But on the other hand, they would not have done that if the social system involving how such financial matters are handled had not changed, including some impetus from the government. So the social conditions are important, and we have to think about them and how to change them and how to direct them. Still, it is the actions of particular persons and the character traits that those actions express which directly constitute whatever economic wisdom or foolishness we may find exemplified in a given context. So let's look briefly at the personal characteristics which will be favorable to a life exemplifying economic wisdom. And first, we consider the characteristics that are, as I call it, foundational, and probably foundational for any decent form of human existence. You can collect a list of these from almost any of the great thinkers in human history, East or West. A good point of comparison, by the way, is Confucius. But, you know, anyone who's going to be a leader of thought in a social situation is going to have to come to grips with these foundational characteristics. Here we are, of course, in a Christian context, so we will take our list from the New Testament. And now I'm at number 4 on your sheet. In chapter 5 of his letter to the Galatians, the Apostle Paul lists major components of what he calls the fruit of the Spirit and contrasts them with the works of the flesh. He lists love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things, he says, surely with some sly humor, there is no law. No doubt that is just because of the foundational role such traits have in building strong and beneficial relationships and contributing to human well-being. Take them out of human life and you're left with a condition that few would find desirable or even endurable, where the works of the flesh, listed also in Galatians 5, provide the dominant tone and substance of society. Now, here are some of the things that Paul lists. It starts out, for good reason, with sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissension, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these. Now, if you just look at that list and think about it, you'll see what kind of a tone of life and society you get out of it. That is a condition which largely prevails in life around the globe and which contributes heavily to, I would say, makes inevitable the economic unwisdom or foolishness and outright wrongdoing and evil that characterizes so much of the world that we see around us. Just look at the works of the flesh listed and think about what they presuppose and what they produce for economic life. You probably wouldn't want to have an employee that was deeply caught up in those works of the flesh. Compare that to the fruit of the Spirit. A life structured around and animated by the fruit of the Spirit will be one in which the personal relationships discussed in our talk yesterday as central to human well-being are strong and profitable to everyone involved. It will be one in which the further characteristics more specifically required in a life, individual or social, exemplifying economic wisdom, are likely to be present and strongly supported. That is why I call the elements in the fruit of the Spirit foundational. Now let's think briefly just about a few of these. Consider love, joy, and peace from the viewpoint of economic wisdom. Love is goodwill in action. To love something or someone is to act or be poised to act for its or their good. Love of neighbor is a disposition to act for what is good for your neighbor. Or if you see harm coming to them, you act to deflect or diminish the harm. And if they need some good thing, you do what is reasonably in your power to supply it. In the larger social governmental setting, love does what it can to establish and sustain arrangements and practices that will benefit everyone or many if effected, or will benefit the now, at least in the academic world, the now much maligned common good. The restoration of the common good is one of the primary tasks which a spokesperson for Christ should face. Love will oppose institutions and practices that hurt the public or fail to help them. Thus, all the clear cases of the professions are devoted to a common good, though currently many of the professions have lost their vision of what that is. And therefore, these are seen as callings and as groups that are devoted to service, not just to personal gain or practitioners of their profession. Love at the public level will care for the economy because it cares for and loves people. One of the sad things that I've had to watch as a professor at USC was young people who come into their careers, their undergraduate careers, and then they're going to their graduate careers full of idealism as to what the law is about. They think they're going to go into law or medicine or whatever. They have ideals about this. They think law is about justice, and in a short time they find it's about due process, which they discover is very different from justice. Joy is a positive outlook of hopefulness, moving to a second element of the fruit. Joy is a positive outlook of hopefulness based upon a pervasive sense of well-being overall. It, like love, has a feeling component that is pleasant, but it also, like love, is not a feeling. It is a positive posture in life that assumes that good will be supported and eventually triumphant. Joy is compatible with pain and disappointment and sorrow because it always takes a wider view of circumstances and hopes for what is good to prevail. It enables one to be patient in endeavor, faithful in commitments, and is required for the all-important factor in economics of deferred gratification, the ability to say no to desires, or at least a firm not yet. Joy enables delayed or denied gratification. The bearing of joy on economic wisdom should be obvious. It is indispensable to steady contentment and perseverance in a task. It liberates from the demands of the immediate satisfaction rather than what is good. It is one of the offshoots of joy is investment. And there are just many, many ways this comes out. I love the phrase in the psalm, I think it's Psalm 24, about the man who swears to his own hurt and changeth not. And how important that is in a life of economic wisdom, even at the individual level. Peace, now, is a kind of rest that comes from bedrock confidence in the sufficiency and availability of what is necessary and good for me. The song says, when peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, it is well with my soul. A person of peace does not attack others, faces attacks on him or herself with calmness and non-maleficence that arises out of assured abundance. They are not hostile or suspicious or touchy and easily offended. The wisdom that is from above, the Epistle of James says, is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy, and the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. I love that phrase. The seed whose fruit is righteousness. Righteousness is a fruit. Is sown in peace by those who make peace. That's James 3:17 and 18. Now, these few remarks will, I hope, make clear the role of elements of the fruit of the Spirit in a life of economic wisdom. Here we will not be able to discuss each element listed by Paul, but when you add them all together, including patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, or moderation and self-control, you get a picture of a different kind of person from the standard run of the human mill. Upon reflection, you will realize, I think, that the well-being and flourishing that such a person has and promotes in others will strongly influence the social and governmental arrangements that they will be caught up in the natural course of life, and that they will seek to establish and maintain at the structural, social, governmental level. If a person is well developed in these characteristics, they will tend to be capable of being at home in their context and of supporting themselves and others related to them. By contrast, you can observe, I think, that people caught up in a life of economic unwisdom are usually exceptions must always be allowed and understood, are usually lacking in the foundational traits that make up the fruit of the Spirit. I'm going to read that again because it is, I think, something that many people would certainly want to argue with. I say, by contrast, you can observe that people caught up in a life of economic unwisdom are usually lacking in the foundational traits that make up the fruit of the Spirit. Now I'm to number 5 on your sheet. From these foundational traits, certain characteristics that have a more direct bearing upon the economic flourishing of individuals and societies will naturally arise. A long and profitable study of how this works could and should be made. Here we will only make a few comments. For example, love, especially with joy, will certainly promote productivity of goods and services both in quantity and quality. Love naturally focuses upon the production of what is good and seeks to make it widely available. God in creation created what is good. Creation was an act of love and joy and peace. These are the fruit of the Spirit because they also characterize the Spirit. The drive to be self-supporting is almost always tied to the will to be productive and to benefit others. Again, that is observable in human life. Paul remarks on his own practice in 2 Thessalonians 3:8. We did not eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with labor and hardship, we kept working night and day so that we might not be a burden to any of you. And he calls upon his readers to follow his example. Again, he says in Ephesians 4:28, let him who steals steal no longer, but let him rather labor, performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with him who has need. A very interesting study recently was done on Templeton money. It discovered, I'm so thankful that some social scientists now are beginning to do this kind of work. And this study discovered that God's love leads to increased benevolence among Americans. And this resulted in a book with the title, The Heart of Religion. It said almost half of all Americans fear God's love at least once a day. Yeah. 8 out of 10 have had this experience at least once in a while. A similar number have felt God's love prompting their compassion for others. At least occasionally, with almost a third feeling of compassion daily or more often. Furthermore, the experience of divine love proved to be the most consistent predictor of 6 different forms of benevolence. Now, this is social science in its glory. Wonderful to see that. Whether giving time or money, helping friends and family, or working to make the world a better place, the findings suggest that for many Americans, the experience of divine love and practical benevolence are inseparable. Now, what I would look for is another study that links the experience of love with the factors such as industrialism, faithfulness, and promises, and so on. And I will guarantee you they will find it large. But that needs to be done. We need to link the experience of love to all of the factors that go into a life of economic wisdom. Well, I just refer that to you. It had a lot of interesting findings in it, I thought. Peace eliminates hostile relationships that hinder productivity and waste human talent and energy. It enables helpfulness to dominate human relationships.
joy in working and sharing makes anything easier, and adds strength of its own to any endeavor. These traits also foster restraint that makes for economic well-being. The elements of the fruit of the Spirit put one in a position to be patient in undertaking, capable of deferred gratification, not wasteful or foolishly indulgent, not unable to say no to what one wants, or as a leader to what a group wants. The ability to say no to desire enables the individual or group to distinguish between a want and a need, and to keep wants in their proper limited place so far as decision and action go. I was gratified to see some weeks back Wells Fargo Bank prints little messages on their deposit slips and so on. And here's one that came up for a few weeks. Create a budget and keep a log of your daily spending to help you discover places to save. Review your budget and log weekly and highlight wants versus needs. Now, if that advice were followed, I venture that Wells Fargo would be less strong. And so I thought it was very courageous of them to put that out. Maybe they hadn't thought it through. Now, this distinction between want and need is, of course, of overwhelming importance at the level of government, where once deficit spending or distribution of wealth or something like that is adopted as a way of getting on, once simply run wild for lack of leaders who can say no to their constituency. And this is an old problem that's thoroughly studied in Plato's Republic, book 7 through 9. I recommend that text to you because Plato had seen this happen. And he knew that democracy, and we, by the way, don't have a democracy, we have a constitutional democracy, that he knew that democracy, unrestrained and undirected, was the next step before tyranny, because only tyranny could shut down the effects of a government which was simply running to say yes to the people. Thrift. Now, an interesting thought. Thrift as a central practice is then abandoned. I don't know how much you hear about thrift in the discussions of the federal budget. Thrift is now an old-fashioned idea. It is, in general, essential to economic well-being and flourishing. I've often been impressed by the fact that when Jesus fed the thousands on two occasions, they collected the scraps. And one might think, well, why do that? I mean, this guy can just produce whatever you want. You have 12 baskets full in one case, I think 7 in another. Thrift. But thrift and flourishing are now words that do not comfortably fit together, if they even show up. Consciousness, thrift is thought of as shabby. But that has not always been so. They used to sing about thrift. I have a little book from 1926 that has some songs in it, and one is around. You know, or you sing it as around, and here are the words. Eat it up, wear it out, make it do, go without. Now, can you imagine the community getting together to sing today? This was also a period in which, of course, the community did come together to sing. And what a tremendous thing that in itself is. Now, a need, as opposed to a mere want, is a lack of some kind that, if not properly met, results in serious harm to the functioning of the system in which it occurs, or even the demise of that system. For example, malnutrition in very young children, lack of intellectual or artistic stimulation in early childhood, or the failure of an infant to emotionally bond with significant adults. At the social economic level, freedom to exercise initiative creatively and to reap the rewards and sorrows of risk and effort is a need which must be met if self-regulating productive life is to be attained. It is the foundational character traits from the fruit of the Spirit that can enable the individual, and by extension the group, to say either yes or no to what is required or not for a life of economic wisdom. It is certainly the task of the Christian spokesperson to teach, train, and exemplify both the foundational traits and the more specific traits required in the economic domain: industriousness, self-control, moderation, responsibility for oneself and others. That is the responsibility and posture of love. And as spokespersons, we have to carry through with love in that respect. Public well-being and prosperity essentially depend upon these traits, properly understood and implemented. Now I'm to point six on your sheet. I think we have to concede that welfare is not something that can be produced for people generally, though some provisions for general welfare can and must be made. The general welfare can be destroyed by events or by foolish policies and actions. But welfare is essentially also a matter of the character of the people involved. St. Augustine says in his rule that those who have the strength to lead simple lives should consider themselves the richest of people. For it is better to be able to make do with a little than to have plenty. I love that sentence because there's nothing that so captures the inversion. Very few people would recognize this sentence, much less say it. It is better to be able to make do with a little than to have plenty. Now, making do with a little is going to be directly tied to the fruit of the fruit of the Spirit. What an idea. The character of a people in a population is hugely determinative of how well off people are and whether or not they and their society flourishes. Some dimensions of welfare or flourishing can perhaps be quantified and dealt with abstractly and externally, but two people in the same material conditions may not have an equally good life or be equal in welfare or well-being. Because of their attitudes and understandings, and especially because of their human relationships, their lives may be quite disparate so far as human well-being goes. $50 in the pocket or hand of an intemperate or ignorant person is not equal, so far as welfare is concerned, to $50 in the hand of a wise and virtuous person living in the network of sensible friends and relatives. A safety net is one thing, and in some measure it might be provided for a population, at least so long as the money or credit lasts. But well-being or a flourishing life is quite another thing. It cannot be handed to people generally, if it ever can be handed to anyone. It is something which must be seized inwardly. It's like knowledge. You don't know. Certainly, you know because you have risen up in your mind and sought and grasped something. Now, point seven on your sheet. And I've spent so much time on these matters of character and fruit of the Spirit. I don't want that in any way to indicate that we can leave the public issues alone. The work of the responsible Christian spokesperson is not done with having pointed out the traits that most essentially enter into human well-being. It is far, by far the most important thing we do, I believe. But now we want to look at a few extensions of that work which have special involvement and significance for public life, including the functioning of government. And with that, we return to number two in our list of three things which are presupposed in any life actually exemplifying economic wisdom. It is, of course, true that Christian spokespersons are not to dictate governmental or other large-scale policies. They are not in a position to do so, and that is a good thing, really, because they have something much more important to do, but also because they're not especially qualified to dictate. That's a different set of qualities. They are in a position to address economic and social issues that affect all citizens and not just those of their particular flock. Not every person in pastoral or other Christian position should do this, but many should. The well-being of their neighbors is every issue, and love dictates that they speak the truth as best they can to as wide an audience as they can access in the various ways of speaking, writing, and communicating. That is the well-established role of the prophet in the biblical picture of life. And the prophet in that model, we must understand, is something essential to human society. It is something that Jesus himself did. And though not for everyone in ministry, for those called and gifted, it is their necessary task. People in positions of power, governmental and otherwise, including ecclesiastical, should be under the constant scrutiny of Christian leaders. And I ask you the question, who else is to do this? Now, those leaders do not like it. They would prefer not to be under the scrutiny. And they may react in ways that are dangerous. And many of the institutions of government of all kinds like to establish internal agencies to review them. But this is all caught up in the proverb of appointing the fox to watch the chicken. And it doesn't work well. The Christian, the prophet, in the Old Testament model and the New Testament model, including Jesus and John the Baptist, is essentially an outsider. And that is required. Government is executed by human beings, and those human beings tend to drift in the direction of interests of the government and its employees. This often means in the direction of the world, the flesh, and the devil, and we have all kinds of illustrations of this. And of course, this is another area where journalism should exercise a role which unfortunately it has ceased to exercise. Except after the fact, they can find a juicy morsel to put on between the advertisements on the evening news. What it should be accomplished for the public good, and how it is to be done by judges, legislators, and executives, and those in public service, civil servants, we call them, cannot be left up to them. Context, if not mere egotism and group identity, usually, not always, and we have some outstanding examples of people who have gone against the tide, people like Alan Simpson and Tom Coburn in the Senate, overwhelms them. And this is where the prophetic voice must come into play. And it is something that only spokespersons for Christ can exercise. It is a sad mistake of many ministers to suppose that they only speak to their church or constituency. Christ speaks to the world and about everything that really matters. It is our responsibility to follow him and be with him in this task. Again, not equally for everyone, but for many and outstanding examples of people who would do this work. This is especially important in a situation where government accepts the responsibility for providing welfare for its people. Of course, in some measure, it is right that it should do so, but where welfare has come to mean that the government has a responsibility of securing a comfortable form of life for recipients, entitlements will eventually explode, and deficit spending becomes inevitable and uncontrollable. And of course, we're caught up in the middle of all of that right now. And it is because those in positions of power cannot say no. A no will cause a great deal of pain and harm for some people. People will suffer. For many, it is a tragic situation. But neither the individual nor the government can live perpetually beyond its means. This is an essential part of economic wisdom. And perpetual deficit spending with no plan of recovery, or at least a sense of how to go about stopping the overspending and paying off the debt. But it matters. Probably just a blind hope that somehow it will work out. John Maynard Keynes, who was a great sponsor of deficit spending, was often told that sooner or later Britain would have to pay off its debt. His reply, I'm told, was, sooner or later, we'll all be dead. Well, that is certainly true, and in one way, solves the problem. At least for those who are dead. So now, that I think is extremely important for the spokesperson. The pastor or spokesperson also has the task of preparing some of those under his or her influence to step into and occupy positions of influence at all levels of society, including government. This should be a major project on the part of the ministry, if you will, is to encourage, inform, develop people for positions of leadership at all levels. The word I like to use, but I don't use it very often because it's kind of sinister, is infiltration. We do not dictate government, but we must infiltrate. We must have people who are present where the decisions are being made, who will exercise judgment based upon their character, and the character that they understand to be central to a life that is to be well lived. So the spokesperson for Christ has the task of preparing some of those under his or her influence to step into and occupy positions of influence at all levels of society, including government. This means the development of a character that will allow the individual to play a role in public leadership, which leads in the direction of economic wisdom, and not just for securing their own position and advancing the interests of their citizens. For the Christian, of course, this means identification of the leader with a servant of all, with a servant. And she lines up to serve what is good, not to get reelected. It is only through leaders that a society or government takes on the qualities of economic wisdom. A group, a social group, has to have the leaders to form them. One cannot expect to achieve this merely by getting the right management system or something of that sort in place. The pastor and teacher must talk about this and stress that such leadership is a call on the lives of many Christians as well as others. We must emphasize that it is a holy calling. Of course, a Christian in such a position can only survive and thrive by the hand of God moving with him or her. But that is just another day in the life of those whose actual citizenship is in heaven, as Philippians 3:20 says. We should explicitly assume that all of this is the case, and if we are in a position of leadership, count on it, along with those in our discipleship setting, that we would be taking positions where only God can save us, And here, of course, Daniel is the most outstanding example of someone who did that. We should do what we can to help such people, help them gain and sustain positions of influence where their judgments and examples can make a difference. Finally, the Christian spokesperson must make a point of knowing what is taking place in his or her world, and this is not an easy thing. I think some will have to take over the role of investigating reporting, which has been largely abandoned by journalists. They must go out of their way to be informed and personally interact with leaders in social and economic matters. Here, Christian academics and specialists must come to their aid. Being properly informed is more difficult today, since what we call journalism now has, for the most part, degenerated into a branch of entertainment. And journalists almost never look into and responsibly inform the public on matters that deeply impact it. Whenever the journalists, when the series of financial disasters that have unfolded over recent decades, from the famous savings and loan scandal onward to Enron, were developing, well, you know, they were reporting on lip syncing or something to that sort. Again, this is not for everyone in the position of Christian ministry. I'm not saying that. But it is for some who are in that position. And it is further the responsibility of the experts who occupy positions in higher education, and specifically Christian higher education, to prepare those who exercise this ministry. This ministry to the church and to the nation and to the world for effective execution of their special tasks. They must expose the economic fallacies of government or society dominated by desire alone and by the contest, the power contest that arise from that. So thank you for your attention and your patience, and I look forward to your comments and criticisms.